So the Cuba Committee and KFAI invite you to discover Cuba through the cinematic lens of the 17th Annual Minnesota Cuban Film Festival. Films are shown every Wednesday evening from March 4th through April 1st, 7 p.m. at the main cinema on Minneapolis's historic waterfront. See and hear about Cuba from the viewpoint of Cubans living there. Festivities include exclusive screenings, audience Q&A sessions, and a closing night music party. Tickets and information can be found at mspfilm.org or find the Minnesota Cuban Film Festival page on Facebook.
The viewpoints expressed in this program are the opinions of the people expressing them and are not necessarily those of Fresh Air Incorporated, its staff, or its board of directors.
You are listening to Fresh Air Community Radio, KFAI 90.3 FM, Minneapolis, St. Paul, and around the world at KFAI.org. Non-commercial, community-powered radio. Thursdays at this time, it's the Northern Sun Radio News Show with Don Olson and Dave Kudnick.
Thanks, Don.
Dave, you're going to start off with a little bit about our first piece that we're going to have having to do with the Ukraine.
Yes, it jumps right into some of the current attacks from Ukraine into Russia, sabotage and terror type of attacks. But I want to take a few minutes to give some historical context for all this, because people forget and they're not encouraged to learn what the roots are of this very tragic war, which is destroying Ukraine. Ukraine is a proxy, a sacrificial victim to a long-standing, very deep war between the West and Russia, with the aim by the West to weaken Russia. It goes back to the British Empire and ethnic anti-Slav prejudice. It goes back to the Cold War with USSR and post-USSR 1990s. When disaster capitalism came and almost succeeded, it did succeed in creating some oligarchs, but basically the ties to Western capital were greatly restricted during that whole period. So again, a reminder, what's war for? Well, it's for war resources and power, and Russia just happens to be the largest commodity producer in the world. We're talking agriculture, metal, and other such commodities. So it's a tremendously rich country. And again, reminding you, what are wars typically about, despite the cover story? So another key issue is mutual recognition of sovereignty and security concerns. And the U.S. has demonstrated over and over and over, especially articulating an opposition to any peer competitor since the 1990s, that we don't recognize other nations, Russian or other security concerns, as being on a level with ours. And look at what's going on with Canada. Do we recognize sovereignty, or Cuba, Venezuela, and 100 other examples? No, we don't. That's a key issue, mutual recognition of sovereignty. So again, before jumping into the Ukraine testimony by Matt Ho, I want to remind people of the post-World War II history, where the CIA sponsored Ukrainian, formerly Nazis, who killed lots of Jews, lots of Poles, and along with lots of members of the Red Army. And we continued working with these people to engage in sabotage against the USSR in the 1940s and 1950s and into the 1960s. So again, reminding you some of the roots of this. NATO expansion is a key element of the war that we're in today. And in the 1990s and into the 2000s, there were prominent voices saying how key Ukraine was to the conflict between the U.S. and the NATO-based military empire and Russia. And Brzezinski, the famous theorist of empires, said that Ukraine was the key to weakening Russia, or Russia being strong. U.S. ambassador to Russia Burns, now head of the CIA, William Burns, in a famous statement, a long email to Condoleezza Rice that was released thanks to WikiLeaks, in which he, Burns, expounded at length upon the danger of having this war, that it was an absolute red line for Russia and would lead to civil war in Ukraine and intervention in Ukraine by Russia. And my view is that this was rejected, this warning, because war is what we wanted. And it was warned against also by every Russian president, by Yeltsin in the 90s, by Putin, by Medvedev. Finally, of course, we sponsored a coup in 2014 where the democratically elected government, which was, had decided to probably favor a trade deal with Russia rather than the EU, was overthrown, and it kind of went from there. So, and then, of course, it escalated greatly in 2022 after Russia's advocacy of a European security agreement. There's that issue of mutual recognition of sovereignty and security concerns. Russia's proposal at the end of 2021 was completely rejected, and plans were already underway for war, and that's what we got, of course, in this month, 12 years ago, was it now, 2014, and then 2022, sorry, 4 years ago. The other one was, the previous decade. So it's continued to escalate. And it just before we go to the tape, one last thing to, again, remind people of the roots of this, that Zelensky himself, in 2022, after the war had expanded, the Russian Special Military Operation had intervened, and Zelensky said on tape, I've seen it myself, that there's one problem in that some in the West do not want the war to end. This is when negotiations had initially begun after March, in March of 2022. Zelensky said some wanted the war on Russia to continue, to weaken Russia. So again, illustrating quite briefly the kind of long-term agenda I'm talking about.
To weaken Russia, that was the same words that the U.S. Secretary of Defense, Lloyd Austin, said when he was over in Ukraine, that the war was there to weaken Russia. They wanted that to happen.
Yeah, Boris Johnson said the same thing, that it was to preserve the Western dominance.
So let's hear Matt Ho. He was formerly in the State Department, U.S. State Department. He was a U.S. Marine Corps captain in Afghanistan and Iraq. And he was on Judging Freedom with Judge Napolitano. This was posted on Tuesday. It'll be a short piece, and we'll get to some other parts of his talk later, but Matt Ho, H-O-H.
Hi, everyone. Judge Andrew Napolitano here for Judging Freedom. Today is Tuesday, February 24th, 2026. Matt Ho joins us now. Matt, always a pleasure, my dear friend. Thank you for accommodating my schedule. Before we get into the American complicity in Israel's expansion, what is the significance, in your view, of Ukraine's use of a British missile and American intelligence to attack and severely damage a Russian munitions plant 800 miles into Russia?
Well, thanks for having me on, Judge. Yeah, I mean, this is the way the war will continue to go unless it's brought to an end through a negotiated political settlement. And the powers outside of the war, specifically the Western powers that have provoked this war, sustained this war, enabled this war, they'll continue to be reined into it. And the Ukrainians, of course, of course, they're going to use whatever help they can receive, will continue to do so. So these types of long-range strikes that may or may not have any real impact on one of the other nations' ability to actually wage the war will continue, and they'll increase because the perceived PR value, public relations value of these types of strikes are what's important. So particularly for the Ukrainians, demonstrating to their European backers, demonstrating to those in the U.S. who still back them that we're still in this fight, we can win this, keep sending us money and weapons.
Wow. And if the Kremlin retaliates, I mean, Larry Johnson is of the view that the Kremlin is considering retaliating on the munitions factory that makes the missiles, one of which was sent to destroy this Russian munitions factory. And this British factory is in a suburb of London.
I think we're still far away from that, Judge, but it's not something that you just dismiss outright, though. You know, the possibility of us getting to that point where the Russians launch a missile to destroy a factory in Britain, that's foreseeable. That certainly, if you go back, because today is the fourth year anniversary of the start of this war. This is when the Russian troops came across the border. And, you know, this is the four-year anniversary of this. So we're now officially in the fifth year of this war. And, you know, something like that, if you brought it up 4 years ago, you'd be mocked, you'd be derided. And in some circles, you still would be. I mean, there certainly are those out there who, you know, look, what you've been saying, what the folks on your platform have been saying, I think what many of the people who watch and listen have been saying has proven correct about this war. This is a war that Ukraine cannot win and Russia cannot lose. You know, so the idea of the war expanding, whether it be horizontally with increased, more advanced weaponry, more dangerous weaponry, that's vertically, horizontally, where it expands across the borders. Yeah, absolutely, Judge. Why is that something that's, you know, shouldn't be taken into account? And the commentary from the Russians suggested, I think you'll see other things much before that, such as, say, maybe Russians seizing European ships. That might be something you see, you know, but this idea that, yeah, this could be getting into the early days of World War III if we don't find a negotiated political settlement. Yeah, I mean, you know, I think you're a fool if you don't believe that's a possibility.
Before we jump to Iran, does the Kremlin have the ability to end the war in a week?
I don't know, Judge. I don't know about that. I think they could certainly persecute the war with a heavier tone to it, with a more destructive point to it. They could flatten, say, all the government buildings, start flattening all the civilian infrastructure, you know, and start really going after the key logistics and lines of communications in Ukraine's rear, particularly those areas where NATO pushes equipment into Ukraine to make the war a lot harder for both the Ukrainian military and government, as well as for the Ukrainian people. But to end the war, no, I don't think that's possible. I mean, that would require the capitulation of Kyiv, and that would require the conquest of not just, you know, central Ukraine, but also western Ukraine. So I don't think that's something that's doable. But certainly the idea that the Russians could make this war a lot worse in a week's time, absolutely.
All right. Switching gears.
Well, we'll switch gears later on. So that was Judge Napolitano there on his Judging Freedom there with Matt Ho, formerly with the U.S. State Department, and he's he was a U.S. Marine Corps captain. Now, Dave, one of the things now with all these media, both public and corporate, none of them ever talk about how the whole shebang, the whole war, could have been called off right at the very beginning.
Yeah, the judge's questions weren't that great in that clip, because instead of asking could Russia end the war within a couple of weeks, I think the more pertinent question is could the U.S. end the war within a couple of weeks, since we're primarily arming and funding the regime in Kyiv, the unelected, you know, unaccountable, extremely corrupt regime there. Where's all that money going? And so I think that we should look at what the U.S. is doing and what it could do to end this war.
It's it was penciled in, as Professor Jeffrey Sachs has said, that the agreement was there where the Russia would pull back and that the essential outline of the Ukraine would be kept and Ukraine would be neutral and that the push by NATO to further encircle Russia and being able to put missiles, perhaps, missiles into eastern Ukraine would be something that the Russians were worried about because whereas previously NATO has put missiles, tubes, into Poland and then Romania, and they said, oh, well, you know, this is not against Russia. This is in case Iran attacks. Well, that's 1,000 miles away. But it would, missiles fired from Poland, say, you know, it would take 9 minutes from eastern Ukraine, it would take 5 minutes. So it's a much more destabilizing. And plus, it's one more part of the encirclement, which, if you look at it, has been this whole expansion of NATO, which the U.S. agreed not to expand to the east, which they did anyway, starting under Bill Clinton as president, that it's came pushing further and further. And so Russia tried to have some sort of a security arrangement, even in December 2021, before the whole start of going into the Ukraine happened, and the U.S. summarily disagreed with it. And
you'd think that after the two world wars in the 20th century, utterly catastrophic, centered in Europe, that there would be interest in European security arrangements so we don't go through this again. And yet here we are preparing for it once again because, as I've said several times, there's a question of mutual recognition of security concerns. We didn't want to learn that lesson in the Cuba crisis, and we don't want to learn it now. Since the 1990s, as Don said, we've said we don't want any peer competitor, and we're going to expand NATO. A really critical year was 2008 when there was a big argument at the Munich Security Conference about declaring that we're going to get Ukraine and Georgia into NATO, and this was strongly opposed by Germany, France, and others, and they gave in. And that kind of, you know, the die was cast from that point, in my opinion, because, again, Russia had made clear that this was a red line. Don gave a few statistics there about how many minutes it would take for their missiles. We've got to recognize some of these spheres of influence, however distasteful you might think that is. If the U.S. can claim such a thing, well, then so can other great powers.
Yes. And so this agreement that I was referring to from Istanbul would have gone into effect, except that the Boris Johnson, UK Prime Minister, flew to Kiev in April 9th or 15th area and said, don't sign it. Don't sign that agreement I was talking about, and the West will back you. So yeah. To my mind, this is a NATO-US war. It would have been stopped way back 4 years ago. Think of all the destruction, human and material, whatever else, but it keeps going on. And what's the phrase, Dave, that we used to hear time after time after time after time?
Well,
unprovoked.
Yeah, okay, I'll get into that, but I also want to mention that those of us opposed to the war have said that Johnson's message and the U.S. message 4 years ago in Istanbul was And that text of that bio, the way it was published later, so it was definitely about 95% complete. And instead, what we wanted was to fight Russia to the last Ukrainian. That's my opinion of how we view Ukrainians as a sacrificial proxy for the long-term deep war on Russia. As far as describing that war, Don and I have talked many, many times in the past, not only about some of the history I've touched on, but especially the matter of whether the war was provoked. And there's things we can point to. I've done it again today about how it was provoked and provoked and planned and provoked for years. But every time in the New York Times and all of the mainstream media that was repeating the approved narrative would bring it up, they would say not Russian aggression, but unprovoked Russian aggression, unprovoked, unprovoked. It was said a million times, even though it wasn't true. But they succeeded, I believe, in embedding that into the mainstream public consciousness. So you don't even hear it as much anymore because it's sort of assumed. Now the latest one is illustrated by a very lengthy article from Masha Gessen, who's an exiled Russian, very bright and a skilled propagandist, writing for the New York Times, previously New Yorker and elsewhere, and other appearances in the media. And she has this lengthy piece in Sunday, I believe it was the Times magazine, in which one of the things she's going on and on about is how wonderful and great Ukrainian democracy was until this war. And yet it was known and declared by the EU Commission and well known to be the most corrupt country in Europe. And it got worse after we overthrew the democratically elected government in 2014 and overthrew the Constitution, by the way, which called for neutrality, which is the key issue over and over and over. Neutrality in Ukraine is what Russia is asking for. And we probably are going to need to return to that. But a couple more points about Masha Gessen, because, again, they have to keep repeating the propaganda. This is why Don and I try to combat, just with a few weak facts, some of the history. And she speaks about Ukrainian democracy, and yet after 2014, they suspended the Constitution. They drove out or killed opposition politicians. They suspended much of the press. They started bombarding the rebellious Donbass provinces who didn't want to have anything to do with the Kiev regime. They started discriminating against the Russian Eastern Orthodox Church. And yet, Gessen blames the Ukrainian loss of democracy on Russia, on the war. And so her thing now is, in a key point, is, well, first of all, turning point. This is the turning point. Just hang in there and deal more weapons, more money. Russia's weakening. We're gonna get through. Ukraine's gonna win. So hanging on and some kind of turning point is promised to us over and over and over. Less embedded propagandistic term I want to point to, and then I'll hang this up, is the full-scale invasion of 2022 was not at all a full-scale invasion. So whenever they mentioned a special military operation, they'll call it a full-scale invasion, and yet it was fewer than 200,000 soldiers trying to force Ukraine to a negotiations, which succeeded immediately. Ukraine, meanwhile, had an army 5 to 10 times that size. So it was not full-scale. The point of it was to stop the bombardment of the Eastern Oblast, Russian compatriots, is how they were viewed, and to force negotiations, which happened within 2 days. And this is the key why the Istanbul talks are key. And again, this is when the West came in and said, no, don't sign it. We'll back you all the way.
The whole thing about that keeps going on and on, and it's, you would think that all these people who are big foreign policy people, they could easily read as much as we have. We've dug into it more, but they don't do it. And they, some friends of mine say, well, you know, they're just there to support the empire, support the war, and support this kind of a military outlook and all that. It's just one thing after another.
If you don't support it, you don't get to the media positions that allow you to repeat the approved narrative. You don't get there if you don't support it.
Yes, and you you don't get the right promotions. You don't get the right jobs. You don't get being called to talk before as a guest and certain so many of the shows.
It's elements of manufacturing consent.
Okay. A lot of people think, well, Russia doesn't have a very good way of treating their own people. Isn't that enough of a reason why we should have war?
Why? Yeah, on the assumption that we're entitled to tell other countries how to behave and to intervene subtly or not at all subtly if we don't like their policies. So there's a question there again about mutual sovereignty. We've got to get to that lesson, and the U.S. in its arrogance is going to take a mighty fall before we get to that, I believe.
Yes. Well, we've there's been a lot of articles about yesterday. Star Tribune was an associated article about how Russia is risking its future by remaking the economy for war.
Yeah, this goes on and on and on. 16 different versions of Russia's weakening, Russia's weak. You know, Russia's using chips out of washing machines for its missiles because they're running out of chips. Some of the most ridiculous stories. Of course, Putin deathly ill. Haven't heard those for a while. It just goes on and on from the most crude in our daily media to more sophisticated types like Masha Gessen.
It's, well, for whatever reason.
Just keep it going. Keep it going.
That's right. They've had to keep it going.
And anyway, it's nothing to celebrate if other countries are having problems. For crying out loud, we should be cooperating instead of threatening war and more war.
So this is, we put forward the idea, if you look at the history of it, Russia was not a threat, had to be made into a threat, and it's goes on and on and on. How to wreck an economy, that's how the U.S. approaches the world.
Yeah, we really, really believed, I believe that our leaders, war makers, believed that the most extreme economic sanctions ever levied on another country, along with draining them through the war, would, again, weaken Russia and lead to regime change in Russia, the overall goal. And, of course, the sanctions have badly failed. You know, we're learning some lessons about limits to U.S. power. Unfortunately, it's leading to a divided world. As I said, we could be cooperating. Now we're developing not just parallel weapon systems, but parallel financial systems. And the U.S. financial position, which has been key to its empire and dominance, is now eroding significantly. People are seeing it, talking about it every day now.
Well, before we get to our take on things on Iran, I wanted to let people know that The Nation magazine, which has been around for 175 years, has a front page just out March issue. The Nation nominates Minneapolis for the Nobel Peace Prize. And they made their submission to the Norwegian Nobel Committee that has longtime observers of the struggles to establish peace and justice in the United States and around the world, and as editors of a magazine that is proud to have included several Nobel laureates on our editorial board and masthead, including the Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King, we believe Minneapolis and its people merit consideration for the prize. And so they make an example, too, about how never before has a city been nominated. But Minneapolis, they say, and it has met and exceeded the committee's standard for promoting, quote, democracy and human rights and work aimed at creating a better organized and more peaceful world. Susu Jeffrey reminded me that she had been part of the nomination of the Honeywell Project Alliant Action by virtue of, in 1967, getting out to vigil in front of the Suburban Arms corporate headquarters by 7 a.m. every Wednesday morning for 15 years, regardless of weather or holidays. And in 2017, the Nobel Peace Prize was awarded to ICANN, the International Campaign to Abolish Nuclear Weapons, by working with the Women's International League for Peace and Freedom, WILF, and WAM, Women Against Military Madness. So it's these women-led organizations, and it's pretty widespread here. I mean, I was just, people were calling me up from around the country. How is Minneapolis able to do that? But people acted very well, and with all sorts of ways of trying to get illicit, wrong responses, bad responses that could be used. So let's go on to Matt Ho on the judging freedom. And this will be an area about Iran.
Is the U.S. war on Iran inevitable? I'd like to think not, Judge. And, you know, the only person who knows the answer to this is Donald Trump. I think that's something we can be pretty assured of. The problem is we can't be assured of what Donald Trump's thinking. God knows if he knows what he's thinking, right? And I wish that was
assured of his thinking from 1 minute to the next.
Right. You know, and I wish we were just being glib, right, Judge? I wish we were just like throwing it out there to insult the man, like trying to do a bit of back and forth, some type of humor at his expense. But we're not. I mean, this is the reality of watching the American empire move through the world, is that you have an emperor, Donald Trump, who is prone to fits, spasms. He's mercurial, he's temperamental, and as you just said, he doesn't know what he wants to do from one moment to the next. So every day it's, you know, this is as a, you know, as Ray McGovern would say, we're trying to understand the Kremlin here. We're trying to practice criminology, as they used to call it, by trying to read in between the lines. Or there are leaks from various camps in Washington, D.C. or Tel Aviv, trying to make us think that it's going to go one way or the other. Of course, the last day or two, this has been about the story that General Dan Kane, the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, is saying that the war would come with a lot of cost, something that we've talked about. But, you know, then the counter to that, where Trump himself says General Kane has said that the war would be won easily. And then, of course, the counter to Trump's counter so we're just witnessing this politicking in this, again, public relations activity going on. And the reality is the only person who will know the answer to that is Donald Trump. But certainly the forces are there, Judge. The amount of manpower, the amount of equipment, material, the amount of logistics efforts that's put into this, the posturing, as well as, and I think this is the most important thing for me, the inertia of history, right? We have 45 plus years of the United States hostility to Iran, of one administration after another conducting some form of warfare against the Iranian state, against the Iranian people. And now, is this the time for that to culminate? And there's been some argument presented that Donald Trump is obsessed with this idea of being the president who could do what no other president could do. Reagan couldn't do it. Bush couldn't do it. Clinton couldn't do it, et cetera. He'll be the president that ends the Islamic State of Iran.
You know, the headline in the Washington Post was substantial. The copy was substantial. This is a major leak by someone, either in the Pentagon or the CIA, that does not want the war.
I think, Judge, it was across the Post, Axios,
and maybe the Journal or Financial Times, but there were three major media outlets that published this concern of the Pentagon.
Top general sees risk in attack on Iran. General Dan King, chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, expressed his concerns at a White House meeting last week with Trump and his top aides. These people said, these people, in my air quotes, not in the paper, cautioning that any major operation against Iran will face challenges because U.S. munitions stockpile has been significantly depleted by Washington's ongoing defense of Israel and support of Ukraine. King's remarks at the White House have not been previously reported. Before you respond, Chris, can you put up President Trump's posting? He posted this this morning, almost while the ink was still wet on the Washington Post. The story does not attribute this vast wealth of knowledge to anyone and is 100% incorrect. General King, like all of us, would like not to see war, but if a decision is made on going against Iran at a military level, it is his opinion that it will be something easily won. Matt, that can't be his opinion. Nobody says it will be easily won. No serious military person, no matter what their political ideology is or loyalty to the president may be.
Two things, Judge. The first is that when you continue that quote from Trump, he talks about the false reports of non-attacks or the false reports of limited attacks, which might be, now here I am practicing criminology, right? But that might be...
That's because you learned from Ray.
I know. I was just actually texting with Ray earlier, and learning from him, you know, like you said, I'm blessed and I'm grateful in that way. This idea that maybe in this message that Trump put out this morning, there was a tell there by Trump saying that the stories about no attack or a limited attack are false, and that what we will see is a sustained campaign to try and achieve regime change. Like that is the objective, that this isn't just this punitive. This is not to make a statement. Right. This is not just to get the Iranians back in line or just get the Israelis off their back for
so
6 months.
What do you think he's going to tell the American people? His goal is regime change, which he definitely can't justify, or his goal is destruction of nuclear enrichment, which he claims he obliterated back in June.
Right. The comedian Jon Stewart says he should the phrase is re-obliterated in terms of, redoing an obliteration. But I think what he's going to say, Judge, is he's going to keep it close to his chest. I think he's going to do the type of remarks where he lays out how evil the Iranian regime is, how successful the United States under his command has been in putting the Iranians back in check, how no other American president's been willing to stand up to the Iranians, and he'll leave it as an open-ended question. He might say something about the ballistic missiles. He might say something about Iran's support for Hezbollah, for Hamas, for other actors in the region. But I think he's going to kind of dance over that and leave himself a lot of room. That's, I think, how he'll play it tonight on the State of the Union.
So that's Matt Hoh speaking Tuesday on the Judging Freedom. He's a former U.S. State Department official, and also he is a Marine Corps captain in Iraq.
Yeah, but once again, it's worth pointing out some elementary history behind this. Why are we at war? And looking to some of the ostensible official reasons, they don't hold water. And so again, quickly recall the history. Iran is extremely rich in oil and gas. They had a democratically elected and very popular ruler, Mossadegh, who was overthrown by the Brits MI6 and the US CIA in 1953, installed a cruel dictator. Now, absurdly, they're trying to get the Shah's son back in there. And so the attacks have come from the U.S. against Iran. Iran has never attacked anyone. What a war's about, once again, they're about resources and they're about ideological fervor, because if you look into the terrorist accusations and all the terrorist events, they're almost all by Sunnis. and Iran is Shiite. It is very, very different. And so you got to pay attention to some of the facts. It's like, what are some of the arguments about war on Iran? And one is the nuclear arms threat. But we had a nuclear agreement. The JCPOA was trashed by Trump himself. And now, at best, we're going to get back to another version of the JCPOA, which had limitations on any nuclear arm development in Iran, which they agreed to, and with inspections and so on and so on. So the nuclear arms threat, and also it's got a fatwa by the ruler over there against use and development of armed weapons. So these things are facts of the matter, and yet they're all we scream about is the threat of nuclear arms. Now, in our pushy policies, have expanded that to any long-range ballistic missile, as if we can demand that some other country give up any possible self-defense with missiles, because we know what would happen if they did. It's what happened to Gaddafi after he agreed to give up weapons of mass destruction in Libya on the promise of some kind of settlement. Instead, we bombed the heck out of him and killed the man. So the lesson is, don't agree or don't believe U.S. promises. So the nuclear arms threat, I believe, is bogus, and at best we're going to get back to the JCPOA. Secondly, a pretext is that there are Islamist fanatics engaged in attacking the U.S. As I said, they have not been attacking the U.S. They are Shiites, and most of the terrorist attacks, as reported by the U.S. State Department as well as an official French agency, are almost all by the Sunnis. Those are the ones that we've been sponsoring. We sponsored many of the Sunnis. We sponsored Saddam Hussein attacks on Iran by supplying him with the ingredients for chemical warfare, and killed many, many hundreds of thousands of Iranians. Another point of which way the aggression has been going. And again, the terrorist attacks are not attributed to Iran, and very seldom to Shiite groups. Then there's the Hamas and Hezbollah, similarly accused of being terrorists, but relatively few of the acts recorded are by those groups. This is over the last few decades. And finally, there's the argument Iran government is deeply unpopular. Well, a lot of the demonstrations are sponsored by Mossad and the CIA. And in fact, typical of when a country gets attacked, often the result is more popular, more national unity around defending the country and backing the government. So it's very questionable. Of course, you're going to hear from Iranians who are very unhappy about it. But it appears that the government has strong support, as according to polls in Iran. So most of the arguments are BS. There's not a nuclear arms threat. We could improve that by signing, getting back to that treaty. There's not a lot of Iranian attacks or sponsoring of terrorism. And the government is supported, increasingly supported internationally, too, as far as that goes.
The Israel wants not to support any other groups that might be in the way of Israeli expansion. I mean, when Hamas came out of one of the occupations in Lebanon some decades back, and it was formed as a way of countering Israeli aggression. Israel has their sights set on Ersatz Israel, Greater Israel, and they're continuing to have these peace agreements, but they don't observe them. Democracy Now! Has been very good in talking about all the people who have been killed in Gaza, civilians, whatever, and without having any opposition, it could be even worse. And the same thing going on in Lebanon. I've seen news reports, TV news reports on BBC, et cetera, where Israel has expanded where its area that they are occupying inside of Lebanon, and they keep blowing up people's buildings, houses, and pushing them back and attacking willy-nilly. So here So here, do these countries have any right to self-defense, or is it all for Israel?
Yeah, I want to talk about terror and terrorism, which is one of the most important memes that we're propagandized about every day now. Iran is terrorist, so is terrorist. Hamas, Hezbollah, terrorists. A common definition used widely for terrorism is violent attacks on civilians for a political purpose. Okay, that's just to help you think straight, because if you look at what's going on, it's clear and world opinion agrees that the number one source of terrorism is the United States. And Israel is coming in a very visible second. And so I just want to remind people, when you see these terms, try to think about it once in a while. Iran is not a terrorist nation. United States is a terrorist nation. And again, just to back up what I referred to there, international polls by professional agencies such as Zogby, Reuters, and Gallup, and then most recently, again, New York Post, question is asked over thousands of people in many countries, what's the greatest threat to world peace? And the plurality or sometimes majority answer, the greatest threat to world peace is the United States.
There it is. There it is. Should we play a little bit of the other tape we have?
Yeah, I'll give an introduction. Go ahead and start it, because this is Colonel McGregor, who's appearing, Wilkerson, sorry.
Yes.
Right, Wilkerson, Colonel Wilkerson, former State Department Chief of Staff under Colin Powell, and a good anti-war voice and very informed about military matters. And he's talking with Nima El-Kashid, who is Iranian but is based primarily in Brazil, and his site is called Neutrality Studies. He has great interviews on Neutrality Studies.
This is also posted on Tuesday.
I'm helping the situation with people, and let me start with, finally, you remember during the Biden administration, there was a crucial moment in which Pentagon interfered. That was the moment that Starmer went to Washington meeting with Joe Biden, asking to let these long-range missiles to be sent to Ukraine. Pentagon said no. There is no way to go in that direction. That would be hugely problematic and escalatory if we do that. Finally, after sending all these weapons to the Middle East, to the West Asia, we have heard from the Pentagon. And they're somehow saying that they warned Trump of extended war plans, you know, against Iran, because the war can backfire. This war can drag on. And here is what was reported on Fox News considering Pentagon.
Donald Trump's top general is highlighting the potential risks with striking Iran. Now, Joint Chiefs Chairman General Dan Kane has warned it could lead to the possibility of a prolonged conflict in the region. It comes after the president said last week that if no deal is reached over Iran's nuclear program within the next 10 days, he could take military action. Now, according to that Axios report, they wrote, quote, while Kane was all in on the Venezuela operation, he has been more cautious in the discussions around Iran, two sources said. While Kane sees the stakes of a major operation in Iran as higher, with a greater risk for entanglement and American casualties, President Trump hit back on Truth Social, writing, quote, the story does not attribute this vast wealth of knowledge to anyone and is 100% incorrect. General Kane, like all of us, would like not to see war, but if a decision is made on ongoing against Iran at a military level, it is his opinion that it will be something easily won. President Trump went on to say he'd prefer to make a deal, but if they don't, it will be a very bad day for Iran.
Yeah. What is your assessment of what's going on, Larry? Do you think that the military part of the government, Pentagon, is somehow getting somewhere to make Donald Trump himself understand what would happen if Donald Trump decides to attack Iran?
It should. Let me preface my remarks with that. It should. The Pentagon should be urging caution, and for some different reasons that we can go into if you want to, but don't think it is. I think this is a story ginned up by the crowd around Trump. Don't know if Kane was complicit in it or not. I doubt it. But I think it's a story that continues to make what Trump wants to do with regard to diplomacy even more problematic. And by that, I mean, I think Trump likes that problematic nature of his diplomacy because he feels like it gives him an advantage and it puts his opponent at a disadvantage. So he's got all manner of people out there conjecturing in one way or the other in order to make it even a more impossible task for Iran to make any kind of intelligence assessment as to whether or not an attack is coming. And if you've noticed some of his other remarks about maybe I'll just sneak up on them and tap them a little bit, and then if they come back to negotiations and are complied, I'll tap them no more. But if they don't, I'll really tap them and that sort of thing. I think he thinks that that is a part, and some of the people around him agree, of his negotiating tactic. And so we're going to get all manner of information until it happens or it doesn't happen.
Yeah.
And Fox is a conduit for a lot of this to and fro, of course.
Yeah. But do we know that what is the understanding on the part of the whole administration? You think that J.D. Vance and Tulsi Gabbard would be in that, would agree with Donald Trump with the attack on Iran? These two people were somehow more sane than the other, you know, characters.
That's hard to say in the Trump administration. Sanity to a degree. I think Vance and Gabbard are the two people in the administration who, of all the rest of the yahoos, would be most apt to counsel caution. And maybe even, in the case of Vance, to counsel some of the things I was revealing this morning, for example, on another podcast. To wit, we have somewhere around 35 to 40%, depending on who you listen to and what you count, a raid of our military might, a raid around or in the proximity of Iran right now. That means that, one, we are neglecting combatant commander strategies all over the globe. That means that they cannot carry out their combatant command missions of presence, especially important with regard to allies like Japan. They cannot carry out their freedom of navigation missions, fairly important because regardless of what people in the world think about freedom of navigation, it is in fact the United States Navy that assures freedom of navigation, sometimes to its own interest, to be true, but all the time it ensures freedom of navigation. I'll give you an example. When we conducted an exercise recently in China and we did some things to passage points like the Straits of Malacca, like the Persian Gulf in the Strait of Hormuz, like the Bab el-Mandeb in the Red Sea, guess who, and this was an eclectic team, the whole world virtually was represented, major powers and economic interest on this group. Guess who was asked to come first by everyone, including China, the United States Navy, because we have a reputation, deservedly, I think, most of the time, for protecting travel on the high seas. Now, Trump has put this in major jeopardy with his strikes in international waters against so-called drug dealers and such. And he's put it in jeopardy for other reasons, too. But nonetheless, we are the assurer of freedom of the seas. We can't do that in many very important areas right now. Were it to be a problem, we would really have a significant issue. And then lastly, we are really hurting in terms of people. And I know Hegseth has been lying about that periodically, particularly with regard to the Army, primarily because he's taken something like 11% of middle category four people into the Army, which are not good soldiers. They're not people that you'd want to muster for combat, for sure. Think McNamara's 100,000, for example, in Vietnam. So there are all kinds of problems with this besides the fact we're spending the taxpayers' money to the billions and billions of dollars with all this military arrayed around and in the vicinity of Iran. And every day it's more and more and more, which doesn't seem to concern Trump, but I'm sure it probably concerns the Pentagon, and it probably concerns the Congress, those few who do think of the budget from time to time. So all of these things are impacting what is going on here, and all of these things will impact what Trump's decision is more and more the longer he delays.
So that was Lawrence Wilkerson. He's a colonel retired from the Army, and he's a former chief of staff.
And the elephant in the room, not mentioned very much in that passage, is Israel. We're fighting on behalf of Israel, in my opinion, in attacking Iran and in some of the other actions that we've taken there. And there's a question of who's wagging the dog. And there's evidence and arguments. In fact, it was in the Times of Israel that they've got leverage thanks to the Epstein tapes on President Trump. So the point is, there's a deep interpenetration of Israel with the U.S. intelligence, military, and media, and so on. And they are a big part of whatever we do in the Mideast, especially with regard to Iran, who's been named as a target by the Israelis. Unfortunately, we tend not to listen to those occasional military voices warning against consequences of aggressive behavior. And I want to recall just one quick thing. Back in late 2022, General Milley was the head of the U.S. Forces at that point and said this was absolutely the best chance to end the war, the best time to negotiate. The circumstances were not going to get any better, but he was shunted aside. That wasn't the message we wanted to hear. We wanted to pursue the war. Okay, quickly jumping off, I want to remind listeners that Don and I are looking for help from younger folks interested in radio and in politics and discussion of alternatives to mainstream media political narratives. And we'd really like to hear from anybody who is interested in the future of Northern Sun News. It's not that hard to learn the ropes, so to speak, here. There's staff and others to help out. And if you are interested, please contact me, Dave Gutnick, by my Gmail address, and that's davegcoop@gmail.com, DAVEGCOOP, davegcoop@gmail. Be happy to hear from anybody about the future of Northern Sun News. Thanks a lot.
Yes, I've been doing this show since 1980. In fact, this program came out of Northern Sun Alliance way back at the very beginning of KFAI when it went on the air in 1978. And so it's other people did it for a while, and I've taken it over and taken different directions over the years. And so we're happy to talk with people who might want to also be involved with things, reporting on what's going on here. Well, this has been the Northern Sun Radio News Show with your host, Don Olson, and Dave Gutnick is here, and we're going to say that Doug Kane has walked in the room, and Global Beat will soon be coming by.
Welcome to MN90, Minnesota History in 90 Seconds.
When bragging about the Minneapolis recording team, Flight Time, it's hard to know which big names to drop. Jimmy Jam Harris and Terry Lewis have worked with some of the biggest names in R&B and funk music, including Mariah Carey, Michael Jackson, Patti LaBelle, and Janet Jackson. Lewis and Harris met in high school and formed a band called Flight Time. After recording a few of their own albums, they borrowed the name for their new production company, which had an early success in 1983 with the song Just Be Good to Me by the SOS. What really really cemented Flight Time's place in pop music history, though, was their work with Janet Jackson. They produced her breakthrough album, Control, in 1986. Over the years, Flight Time has produced 15 number one pop hits and won multiple Grammy Awards, Golden Globes, and Academy Awards.
MN90 is produced by Ampers, diverse radio for Minnesota's communities. Made possible by funding from the Minnesota Arts and Cultural Heritage Fund. Online at mn90.org.